Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Kaas, but I'm sure that's fairly obvious. If you're new to the podcast, thanks so much for checking it out. The most important thing for this pod is to tell your friends, neighbors, co-workers, whoever is into wine, already loves wine, and wants to learn a little bit more about it. And I'm only giving a bit of a plug because this is episode 50, and, you know, we're weird as human beings. We like round numbers, you know, in baseball. Hey, the guy hit 500 home runs, but if he hit 499, it's like, he's a bum. So yeah, we always like round numbers like that. So it's the 50th episode of the pod, and I just want to talk to you a little bit about what it's about. A shameful story with me, actually a couple shameful stories that I want to get into. First, I was at the LCBO, and if you're not from Canada or Ontario, that's the really only, the 90% are the only place you can go to get wine. And I carried in with me a glass bottle of balsamic vinegar. And, I mean, it didn't look like a large bottle, but it could have posed for a half bottle. I wandered around. Just all I was doing was looking for deals. Just, it's what I do. It's like a lot of people know wine. We just duck in to the local wine store. Often we don't even buy anything. We just look. And so scanned around for about 8-9 minutes, also to get out of the cold. It was, you know, cold day here. It's Tuesday, the 21st of January, as you hear this. This podcast will be released a little bit later. So went around, didn't see anything I liked, and then walked out to leave. And as I was leaving, I got kind of half confused, half sort of stink eye from one of the employees. And I think they're wondering, what the bleep is this guy doing? Is he just brazenly walking out with a wine bottle? And I didn't realize it until I was almost out. I'm like, oh, damn, do I go back in and explain? I'm like, nah, just keep walking. But for a couple seconds, I had this fear that there was going to be, because there's police officer in there. They're, you know, doing a lot better job now. The story covered a while ago about all the thefts going on in the LCBO over the last couple of years. And so I didn't even want to turn back. I was like, oh, do I make a break for it? I'm like, no, don't do that, you dummy. Now you're going to look extra guilty. But it felt weird. Walking out where now I felt like a criminal. So I want to apologize to the staff at the LCBO on French Street East, close to Parliament, east of Jarvis and east of Sherbourne. So my apologies there. The podcast that you're going to hear, it is with a gentleman named Jamie Paquin, and he's got a really cool story. Back in 2011, he started a wine store called Heavenly Vines in Tokyo, and it only sells Canadian wine. And I love the idea of this. I mean, a guy that's been doing it now for almost a decade, him and his wife, and they sell Canadian wine to Tokyo. And it was an interesting interview just about, you know, the culture there, the wines that are enjoyed, and also the fact that, speaking of the LCBO, and I'm not here to be critical of the LCBO, but they certainly take their lumps, that the store that he has in Tokyo couldn't be done in Toronto. So a wine store that only sells Canadian wine, sells a lot of wine from Prince Edward County, from Niagara, it's fully easy to do. The bureaucracy works in Tokyo, but in Ontario, where I've said it before, the LCBO treats us citizens as part draconian, part paternalistic. Here are the rules. And it's like, well, we can't let you, you know, buy this at this time, and we can't let you sell it here or there. You know, it's who knows what would happen to you. So strict regulations. And okay, now we'll allow some wine in a grocery store. Anyway, so it was really interesting. One topic we brought up is Norm Hardy. And because he sells some Norm Hardy wine in his store. And I get why he would. It's really good. It's really well made. It was a very important winery for the development of Ontario wine on a global level. And I think each and every person listening, you're going to have your own personal thoughts. From the stuff I've heard about Norm and what he may or may not have done in the past, what I've heard, I don't like the stories. It sounds you know, just really bad and kind of sleazy, and your classic case of a man in a position of power, a gatekeeper, and abuse of that power, which seems more likely in an industry that's about alcohol, up late, partying, events. You know, it just, you know, feels like it could happen. But we don't have all the evidence. There's been no court case yet. I'm just trying to present both sides. And so people out there that say they would never buy his wine again, I totally get it. For people who buy the wine saying, well, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of other people, their jobs, their families at stake here. And so that's my justification for buying the wine. And, you know, you still have to wait for someone to have their day in court. I get that as well. I can't go absolute on this. I haven't bought his wine since. And part of that is because, you know, the morality side and from stories I've heard. And part of it is, you know, there's a lot of great Ontario Pinot. So I've been able to replace it. But yeah, Norm's stuff is fantastic. Anyone out there who buys his wine, fine. I ain't going to judge you. For those of you who don't buy his wine, fine. I'm not going to judge you. It's for each and every person. But we get into that conversation, and it's certainly not a, you know, you can't buy his wine. I mean, you know, we go into it a little bit, and Jamie talks about the reasons why Heavenly Vines is stocked, has Norm Hardy wine there. So, you know, it's an interesting conversation. Now, I want to apologize. The sound quality isn't great. And I think I realized afterwards some mistakes that I made on my end. I mean, the fact that I've even figured out how to do interviews via Skype is a minor miracle. Trust me, my friends are shocked I can do this, that I can post a podcast on my own. I'm kind of a dummy when it comes to technology. I still have a BlackBerry. I don't have a MacBook. I got an old Acer computer. You know, just one quick story about how shameful I am in terms of being handy. My girlfriend, her parents came over once. This was a couple of years ago. And her dad runs a drywall company. So he's big into construction, very handy. He can build a home. And he was doing some work in the spare bedroom. And he said, Matt, get me your hammer. I went downstairs. All right, I'll get you my hammer. And then About 10 minutes later, I returned with no hammer. I couldn't find it. It was wildly embarrassing. I have 7 different corkscrews. I'm looking at 3 different decanters, but I don't have 1 hammer. In fact, in the end, I had to give him like a hardcover book and said, will this do the trick? So very, very shameful. So just to, you know, keep that in mind. I want to give one little wine recommendation, if you can find it, because I checked on the LCBO, and though they have a Chardonnay from the area, they don't have any Pinot Noir. Tasmania, the little island in Australia, they make great Pinot Noir. I had one last Friday, Dalrymple. I know I mispronounced that, Dalrymple. And it was fantastic. Dark cherry, blackberry, but not overly fruity. Nice balance. On the first sniff, you could tell, okay, this is a good Pinot Noir. And unlike, you know, a lot of Australian reds that are very fruity and come at you and big and bold, this one wasn't like it. And I think because Tasmania, higher altitudes, cooler climates, cool winds, which is great for Pinot. It allows the grapes to, you know, a long time to fully mature. And a lot of the grapes from Tasmania, they're sourced for making Australian sparkling wine because cooler area, more acidity, it works well. And sticking with the theme of, you know, grape, Burgundian grapes, Penfolds, one of the, you know, top most iconic Australian winemakers, they use a lot of Chardonnay grapes from Tasmania for some of their own top-end Chardonnay, they source from Tasmania. So it's a great little island. I've never been a huge fan of Australian red wine. And it's, you know, I haven't tried enough of it. I recognize it. But every time I do, in terms of the Shiraz, the Cab, the blends, things like that, it's never really been for me. It's never really hit my profile. Obviously, there's tons of great stuff there. There's, you know, millions of leaders, thousands of excellent producers who are really smart. It's never really hit my profile. But every time I've tried a Tasmanian Pinot, I've always really liked it. But again, I can't find any at the LCBO. But if you find it, if you see it on a wine menu, give it a shot. It will be cheaper than Sonoma. It will be cheaper, certainly, than France. But you can get some really good quality And I think it punches above its weight. So give it a shot if you get a chance. Anyway, that is it for me. So again, the owner of Heavenly Vines Wine Store in Tokyo, only selling Canadian wine, I get to interview my interview here with the owner, Jamie Paquin. Enjoy.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And for just the second time, I'm doing a Skype interview. Last one was in Ottawa. This one a little bit further from Tokyo at the Heavenly Vines Wine Store. It is Jamie Paquin. And with Jamie, he only sells Canadian wine. When I heard about this story, just really fascinating. I'm really glad I'm able to talk to him from Tokyo. Jamie, thanks so much for doing this.
It's a pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
So what was the inspiration behind starting a Canadian-only wine store in Tokyo?
Well, living in Tokyo here, by the way, I can hear my own voice. I don't know if that's an issue of headphones or something.
We'll try. You know what? I'll take you off. I'll take you off. Maybe if I turn video off, that might make it easier.
Okay. As you might know, Tokyo is known for its culinary sophistication. So if you read the Michelin guide, Tokyo usually dwarfs every other part of the planet every year. So just living here over time, exposed me to, you know, fine dining and enjoying things for their origins and started to appreciate wine more. So as that happened, I'd go home to Canada, dig a little deeper beyond the LCBO and started to discover that our wines were winning all kinds of great world accolades and got excited about that and got it in my head that we should sell Canadian wines here in Japan.
And what I thought was really smart, as you mentioned, is a radius of, you know, close to 40 million people in the Michelin-starred restaurants. So clearly it's going to be a culture that's going to like wine. I'm just curious a little bit more about what is the food and wine culture like in Tokyo?
It's staggering, really. On the wine side of things, I don't think there's on the planet that has so many people that have taken formal wine education. I think it's a byproduct of the Japanese approach to learning in general, so that if you want to know about something, you don't just kind of kick around on it. You sign up and you take classes. So there's numerous wine schools here, but Académie du Vin alone has about 40,000 students on the register across Japan. And the Japan Sommelier Association has about 13,000 members. The numbers are incredible. So you have people that have had structured learning related to wine, and that feeds into their interest in it, and also the number of French and Italian and Spanish and whatnot restaurants here. And, you know, you've heard these of, you know, the Japanese craftsmen, like washing the dishes or preparing the rice before they can move on to the next stage. And I think that mentality, real attention to detail and humility about a craft feeds into just the culinary sophistication here. It's when you go out for dinner here, I'd say you can spend more if you like, but it's generally much cheaper than going out to dinner in Canada, and it's going to be almost always be much higher quality. So quite lucky to live here.
Yeah, it's funny. I always assume everywhere is more expensive than Canada.
It kills me when I go home. It's we're spoiled here.
What's the typical customer like at Heavenly Vines?
I'd say there's a few different segments. So one would be the general wine lover. They're often perplexed when they see the store. We're 8 years in now, so there's a bit more of a foundation of people that know we exist and have had our wine, but still quite often someone's, you know, just comes in because they've seen the sign and they're confused. A good percentage are pretty much, you know, I guess like the type of person that understands the general sort of global landscape of wine, and they know grape varieties and so on. Then you'll get a portion who are those really serious sort of wine lovers. They'll ask you what soil type was that Cabernet Franc grown in and things like that. Then you'll get people that just have a connection to Canada. And then on the trade side, you know, we tend to do best at this stage with the smaller Michelin star restaurants, places that have a strong emphasis on wine rather than more generic sort of restaurants. They tend to still stick with the well-known commodities, and they just want the cheap stuff. And
how did it go for you? Because so you started 8 years ago, so 2012. How was it?
Yeah, 11. So we're in our 2011. Ninth year almost. Yeah.
How was it the first 6 months? Just also in terms of not only sales, but you. I mean, this is something really unique. And the thing about doing something really unique is that's often very scary.
Yeah, I think, more just excited. And luckily, we kind of hit the ground running. We had just by coincidence, Four Seasons was looking for some wine. And we were able to provide that. They had a Quebec chef come in, and they wanted Canadian wines for that. And I don't know how we did it, actually, in hindsight, but we had, at the time, the owners of Laughingstock come in within, I think, the first 6 months to a year at the this well-known club here. I think it was in, what was the movie? The guy that directed Batman.
Christopher Nolan.
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Inception.
Inception. I don't know if, I think in that film, there's some scenes with a helicopter off a tall building in Tokyo, but the Roppongi Hills Club, we did a 60 seat event, about $180 a seat, managed to fill that with do a laughing stock event. So and we did things within our means too. I knew that it would take years to do this. So we didn't just fill multiple containers and hire a team and expect the Japanese market to just open its doors wide to Canadian wine. So we've always done things. Our store is in a really nice spot in Tokyo, but the rent's quite reasonable, and we keep costs down. So we've never. So it was okay, actually. That being said, you know, we weren't selling a ton of wines, but yeah.
Curious about the popularity of Canadian wine in Tokyo now versus 2011.
It's still modest, but one of the things that tells me we are doing something of value is that we do have quite a few of those Michelin-starred restaurants that purchase from us. The thing is, they tend to be small places, you know, 8-10 seats, and you don't get to take over their wine list entirely. So you get a case order here or there. But we have some wine. The way the market works here is, as an importer, Japan is a single market. So I think Canadians have been suffer from like the Stockholm syndrome, the Canadian literal system. But here we, as an importer, we can sell across the country at any level. So as an importer, we can sell to other wholesalers, other retailers online. So we have a bit more of a presence now, and we sell our wine, you know, to different parts of the country. And occasionally people come here after having the wines at restaurants and so on of different parts of Japan. And we joined the Japan Sommelier Association last year to raise our profile within the industry. And one of the things they do is hold seminars across Japan. And so I think that's helping us. In October, we'll be coming to Ontario with the sixth master of wine in Japan as well. And he's become a fan of some of the wines. So that's really promising. It's kind of like, I see it as like, you know, you're raising the circus tent and you've got all the poles and the the canopy all laid out, and each part of it has to be assembled. But I think we'll little by little hit a stage where we're in the conversation in general.
I want to get into the, you know, if there are certain styles and what's the most popular wines in Japan. But before that, I love this quote you did a couple of years ago in an interview. You were talking about ice wine, and you said that ice wine is no more popular here than in Canada. It's a self-perpetuating myth in Canada that Japanese love ice wine. It's simply a fact that when they visit a major winery, they are guided toward ice wine. We are proud of our ice wine, but our portfolio is only about 10%. I thought that was really interesting because it is true. There is, you know, this conversation, not just about Japan, but a lot of tourists, they come to Canada and it's all they want is ice wine. So yeah, I was wondering if you could sort of expand on that quote.
Yeah, and I think I overestimated the percentage of our portfolio in that statement. We just went through the holiday season, and I've asked for almost 9 years now, anyone that comes asking for ice wine, I ask them what they normally drink, and 99.5% of the time answer they were in Canada or they liked ice wine. So it's a completely separate segment of the market. It's minuscule. It's actually an obstacle to our greater potential, because of the strength of that image here, it really pigeonholes us into being a dessert wine and sweet wine sort of category, and it plays into the perception of Canada as this really cold place. So while I'm happy to sell as much as anyone wants to buy, we've really had to work over these years to counter that perception of Canadian wine to get a wider reception and appreciation for what we're doing, and to be taken more seriously for sparkling and still and white wines. And so what I encounter this in any sort of marketing promotion from Canada and so on too, that just this assumption that it's the thing that we need to bring forward. And you know, you can go to most most wine stores in Tokyo and find zero bottles of it's not really you know, where the future is as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, let's go, you know, Japan, second largest export market for Burgundian wines, and I imagine you're pushing this as much as you can, that, you know, Niagara and even more Prince Edward County with the limestone is the land of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. It's kind of, you know, what it's sort of our answer to Burgundy, and even Niagara, the, you know, my interview with, like, say, Thomas Batchelder, I mean, those are killer single vineyard Chardonnay and Pinot as well. How much do you try to push that on customers that if you love Burgundy, you should try Ontario and it's probably cheaper?
That's one of our key messages. It's a really good position for us. like one of the things that I picked up on quickly doing this business is that we had to find our niche, and what I see that as is we present premium wine at reasonable prices. So we tend to bring you know, those top boutique producers or the reserve level wines of wineries, because what I find is, you know, the production costs of making wine in Canada never allow you to compete neck and neck with you know, the cheap Chileans and that sort of thing. But in a category like Burgundy, we can easily show up with wines that are really comparable to wines 2-3 times the price. So that's something that is really strong for us. And the types of wines that you mentioned are probably what we sell the most of.
I'm curious, what sort of support do you get from Canada, from the LCBO or British Columbia, or on a national level? And you mentioned earlier in this interview about the Stockholm syndrome. How much easier is it for you to bring wine in from Ontario than it is for me to bring wine in from Nova Scotia to Ontario?
I've heard some of the discussions you've had about LCBO and kind of makes me chuckle, because you know, I had the same. You know, I grew up there too. So here in Tokyo, you know, I could sell you a bottle of wine and you could take it to the park and have a picnic drink it on the train, if you like. We could open our store 24 hours a day. I can ship anywhere across Japan. We just listed our wines on Amazon too. Wow. You know, we have no relationship with the LCBO because it's not, I guess, their mandate. We buy directly from the wineries. But a lot of the wineries tell us it's easier to send wines to us than it is to do interprovincial business. another fun fact is, you know, when I come back from Canada and I visit wineries, we don't import. You know, I stock up on stuff that I like. And, you know, I often show up at customs with like 36 bottles of wine and you just pay about $1.50 a bottle duty. You're not fleeced for 110% of the retail price or something that they do in Canada. So, and the sky doesn't fall, you know, there's not a bunch of hooligans on the streets, you know, it's just people learn, you know, how to drink and it's just a cultural thing. It's not about regulating, the alcohol. So, and I tell people what a scandal it is that my store would be illegal in Toronto.
Yeah.
You know, and if you've been to a British Columbia private wine shop or Alberta, you can see the difference it makes when someone's truly passionate about advocating for these wines versus, you know, it's a more bureaucratic system. One of the things that's been very clear over the years is anyone that comes to our shop who's from British Columbia or Alberta, eligible about BC wine. Anyone that comes from Ontario or Quebec recognizes almost none of the wines on our shelves and generally thinks Canadian wine's terrible. And I think you can lay that directly in the hands of the differences in the systems there. And then in terms of the support we get, you know, there's people that try to make the best of it, but it you know, best of, you know, what the, you know, whether it's the embassy or yesterday I was at Destination Canada and we're trying to find a way to help. We're going to start to do our own inbound wine tours. So we're starting with the Okanagan in June, and then we're going to try to do Ontario and Nova Scotia as well. So seeing what we can do together, but a lot of that stuff depends on what sort of mandate they've been given, where the budgets are coming from. There's kind of perverse blockages too, like the Ontario trade office here, you know, very, very keen to help us, but they have a huge difficulty getting approval for any budget related to wine. And I think there's a miss, you know, a confusion on that side that this isn't about just, you know, bureaucrats enjoying a bunch of alcohol. It's about promoting an industry. So if you're going to trade in promotion events related to Ontario here, not having the wines to serve is a real loss. I try to just make my peace with that, be happy with whatever positive does come out of it, but just try to do our own thing as much as we can.
Yeah, it's interesting because now you've been a part of that culture and seen how the government works in Tokyo. And just here in Ontario, it is so paternalistic. They are afraid of the citizens. I always say it's a combination of draconian and paternalism in terms of how Ontario controls alcohol.
I always tell there's probably not a single bottle of Canadian wine that's on our shelf right now that I can buy in my hometown in Ontario.
That's crazy.
I take wines back with me. A friend of mine in my hometown loves wine too. And I take stuff from my store and I take it back because he can't buy it there. So, and why can't And I go have a wine store that has wines from the Gaspereau Valley to Vancouver Island, and it can't be available there. So I would say for people to really just not accept any of the rationales for the government-controlled sale of alcohol, it's a real detriment to the industry. It's not fair. We're just so conditioned to accept it there.
Man, we could go on like this for hours, but I want to get back to Heavenly Vines. What are some of the most popular selling wines there in terms of either grape or region or producer?
Yeah, so one of the things in this market is sparkling wine is probably 25% of the wine market. happy to be able to present things like Benjamin Bridge and, you know, 13th Street from Okanagan, Blue Mountain. So those do well for us. It's really nice that people are so passionate about sparkling here. Pinot Noir is a big one, as you mentioned, about Burgundy being such a big focus of this market. So, you know, a lot of the Ontario, Niagara, Prince Edward County and Okanagan Pinots do well for us. And then for the fuller body crowd, Burrowing Owl is a good one for us. And Stratus has some big fans and things like Livy Pen and La Stella from the Okanagan. A lot of it's, you know, there's different people who are comfortable with different price points. Those all do very well for us. Actually, though, I think our number one selling wine is Nova 7 from Nova Scotia.
Oh, yeah? Wait, that's the can sparkling, right?
Well, we don't have the cans yet. We have the bottle. But there's a very famous sommelier here who has, I have to get it in writing and put it on their website, but he thinks it might be favorite. And he's a Burgundy and Champagne expert. So it's quite a statement. I think the thing with it is that the people that like it a lot, like that old, whatever that commercial was. So they buy multiples of dealer wine. It really has a standout identity, and it's been really interesting. I think Benjamin Bridge told me it's the number one selling wine in Nova Scotia as well.
Cool. So I wanted to ask you about Norm Hardy. And I say on the front end, you know, we live in an era now where if someone doesn't agree with everything you say, then that can make them a horrible person. Or, you know, I find we get into our little tribes. And with any issue like this, it's usually more gray versus black and white. I feel bad for a lot of the people that work at Norm Hardy because of just, you know, the horrible things and the allegations going on to the owner. I was curious just your own thoughts on carrying it, on selling it, you know, if you ever debate with it, or if it's as simple as there's a lot of hands that go into making that bottle, and by you selling it, you're making sure that everyone from the grape growers to the people that pick the grapes, that everyone is compensated.
Yeah, I think it's a complicated issue. I think if you look back to what the article talks about, there's a lot of different scenarios in that article. I have no ability to nature of those complaints. I think I support always anyone who's mistreated to have roots for address of those issues. But we have this perverse situation right now where we have social media that adjudicates these sorts of things, and we have cancel culture. And I don't think that's the way to address these sorts of issues. I think anyone that has a legitimate grievance with Norman Hardy, I hope they can pursue those legally or informally and find resolution. But I don't think that means somebody should just vanish off the planet. And it's become this default reaction that when somebody does something that is disapproved, that they're supposed to essentially just disappear. And I don't know what the implicit idea there is. He should essentially just go out in the forest and shoot himself. There's no route to address. There's no route to returning to the fold or making good that's offered. We've had many people who chime in on social media about the wine, and I've asked them, like, well, what should he do then? And I get a million different responses, things like you should donate money to a women's shelter. And I'm like, we need a much more fine-tuned sense of how to adjudicate issues. And so for me, I hope that anyone that is entitled to some sort of compensation or apology or whatever, it gets that. I hope Norm gets the chance to state his side of it. I think people deserve to be able to recover from things that they've done. And as you said, it's many people involved. And I don't see the logic too, that if you think people deserve compensation for Norman Hardy, why would you want to rob him of the livelihood and the capacity to compensate? And I remember reading a few years ago that Carla Homolka was on a PTA school board or something in around Montreal, and I thought if someone like her is entitled to return to society, I think we need to think about these things in a more refined way.
You know, it's funny. We had this and all the political stuff. It's funny how interviews can go. And I thought, yeah, that's really well said. And yeah, what you really want for the most is as much positive resolution as you can get out of this from especially a winery that was so important to the development of the reputation of Canadian wine. I mean, Norm Hardy is one of the is certainly one of the big ones, and I imagine is a popular seller there because, you know, just if you from a pure wine standpoint, that's pretty killer Chardonnay and pretty good Pinot Noir.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. But, actually his wines probably do sell the best for us, overall. But the thing that I debated when that article came out, too, is like, what's my ethical position on this? And like I said, I believe that if he did things, that are depicted in that article in that way, I hope those people do receive some sort of compensation for that. That being said, I also think people are multidimensional, and they deserve to be able to make things right in their life and be seen with a greater multiplicity rather than one dimension of them. And I think a lot of people these days are just afraid of the contagion effect that, if you speak up on this and you say it's more complicated or there's more sides to it, that you'll be tarred with the same brush. But you have to speak, you have to be truthful and honest about what you think is right. So that's why we stuck with them.
Well, when it comes to wine, the only thing, first thing I would cancel is probably a bunch of the hybrids. Wouldn't you like to see, where would you like to see Heavenly Vines? Like, what's the best case scenario for you? You've been open, for 8.5, close to 9 years. In the next 5 years, what would you like to see?
I'd like to see, one of the things back to the education here is what we initially had to deal with was very outdated modules on Canadian wine. So everyone that would find us would be on the hunt for the Vidal ice wine because that's what the textbooks told them. And we're getting a bit of an upgrade on that education now. So they're starting to include the more detailed appellation discussions of Niagara and the new designations in the Okanagan and stuff like that. So that's helping. I'd like to be part of the conversation when people talk about great wines of the world, great cool climate wines, everyone knows we exist here and they think that their wine list needs a Canadian wine or two. That would be, exponential change for us because, they say like there's about 150,000 restaurants just in the Tokyo region. So the potential, is staggering. And we've actually just started doing business in Singapore too. So we're just clearing customs with a number of Ontario wines there and excited about that. I've had to struggle with my poor Japanese here over the years. So that's been an obstacle. But being able to speak fluently in Singapore is a real exciting thing. It's a much smaller market, but still another, 6 million people or so.
Yeah.
And we've already got a dinner event in the works with what many people say is the top hotel in Singapore. Now we did a tasting there in December with Jillian Mann, guy from Benjamin Bridge, and my partner in Singapore, and the chef and his team were really impressed. So we're working on the hotel where Kim Jong-un and had their meeting a year or two ago in Singapore, mm-hmm. Capella. So quite excited about that opportunity. So I think just the recognition in the market, just like people know that New Zealand and Australia and Calgary make great wines, that Canada's part of that conversation. So, and I think we're getting there. It's not something we could achieve overnight, but I think we're making incremental progress.
And finally, I'm not going to ask you to pick a favorite producer or a region. You know, it's like your kids. Of course, sometimes you don't always love all your kids the same. Sometimes one's a bit of a jerk. But what are you drinking now? What's what have you been enjoying?
Well, I have quite an inventory, so there's not too many nights where I have to drink the same thing. But funny enough, I actually just drank some Megalomaniac last night. Some of the bottles I picked up while I was we don't import their wines at this time, but I was really impressed with the recent vintages. But I had a little Howling Bluff Sauvignon Blanc last night too. There's lots to love. You know, basically we're importing essentially the things that we want to drink. So, but from closer to where you are, you know, I enjoy a lot of Taws and Batchelder and Clos and Chase and Norman Hardy and Stratus, Hidden Bay. We've got the 13th Street Gamay Blanc de Noir sparkling wine on its way here for us.
Yeah, that's good. That's a really, yeah. I just had that. That's a good sparkling.
Yeah, I think that'll be exciting. Real shocker for people to taste something like that coming from Gamay. So in general, too, we're trying to really promote Gamay as one of our interesting signature styles. So yeah, lots to love. I think that's the neat thing about the Canadian industry is production is so small, and yet we have a really serious diversity because of what the Okanagan and Niagara can do within a relatively small area.
Hey, so, Jamie.
It gives a lot of options.
Jamie, I really appreciate you doing this. I know it's early in the morning there, doing this over Skype. I'm hoping to do more of these interviews from people all around the world, people with interesting stories. You absolutely have one. I know brave might seem a bit hyperbolic, but I'll just go then cool about you love wine. You're in Tokyo. Why not do something in Tokyo that you can't do in Toronto? And that's a Canadian only wine store. I mean, just that sentiment alone is just nuts.
Yeah, well, it's been fun. And I think, you know, when you feel something, you know, when you're passionate, the thing that, you know, inspired me too is to see Canadians doing something of excellence, you know, and one of the things about Canada, we're such a resource extraction dependent country for so long, we lack our own sort of finished products in a lot of ways. And it gave me a lot of pride to see these people, you know, working against the elements to produce something world class. So it's fun to share.
Hey, Jamie, thanks again for doing the pod.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you. Hope to see you in East Asia.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Audio Boom, Spotify, iTunes, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.